The session is titled Homophobia, a Weapon of Sexism, and I'm taking the title from a book by the same name, written by Suzanne Farr. She's been working in the battered women's movement about 20 years' time. She's from Arkansas, and her book made some connections that I have thought are existing for some long while. You know how that is when you find somebody else who's written that confirms your own beliefs. You sort of grab that up and hold on to it, and it sort of rattles you a bit. But it is indeed a topic, this talking about homophobia and its connection with other forms of oppression, in particular with sexism, is where we'll be focusing today. How many of you are new to my sessions today? A whole host of folks. Well, let me back up and do just a little bit of background about me and what I've been doing here. And this session sort of is toward the end of the line. I've just got another couple days here. I've been here 2 weeks. Last week focused on homosexuality, sort of what is it, what causes it, what does Scripture say. Looked at the six particular biblical passages. So some of us together have been through some of those things. This week have focused more specifically on homophobia. Homophobia definitionally being phobia, fear of, irrational fear of, and homo, the same, fear of same-sex behavior, it's fear of gay and lesbian people, fear of being or being perceived as a gay or lesbian person, or fear of same-sex feelings in yourself or in some other. The other term that has been introduced is the term heterosexism, and that is the societal assumption and norm that the practice of heterosexuality is the only accepted and sanctioned expression of human sexuality. Societally as well, that would fit in terms of our church and sort of religious views about heterosexuality, homosexuality. The current thought about human sexuality is that it is a continuum. It comes from Kinsey scale, and I'll just rehearse this real briefly, although some of you have been through this before with me. Alfred Kinsey, in 1948 at Indiana University, did a study of 12,000 American males about sexual behavior. And in doing that study, they assumed that there were so few people who were homosexual that they were going to be doing a study about heterosexual men. It was a very either-or kind of box theory of looking at sexuality. Now, out of the Kinsey study, because of the responses of those men about their own sexual behavior and the incidence of same-gender sexual behavior among them, a different model has been posed, the current model about human sexuality, which is a continuum model from 0 to 6. 0 on the scale is heterosexuality. And somebody who's at 0 on the scale would have been exclusively opposite gender sexual experiences in their lifetime. 6 would be exclusively same gender experience, then would be homosexual. 3 would be a bisexual or ambisexual midpoint, somebody who had equally experiences with males and with females. At 1 on the scale would be someone who's predominantly heterosexual but has had some same gender experience. It just moves in one notch off. At 2 on the scale have had more heterosexual experience but some homosexual experience. Likewise fashion on the other side. 5 would be somebody who's been predominantly homosexual in their sexual experiences and activity but has had some opposite gender. And so this continuum from 0 to 6 ended up showing that some sort of bell-shaped curve kind of notion of how human sexuality is for us, at least in our experience of it, that there are few people who are exclusively one or the other in the either-or kind of fashion, and many more people who are somewhere between in terms of sexual behavior. Now, as you begin to think about human sexuality, it's much more complex than what our behavior is or who we've been sexually active with. And part of what is used now in working with individuals in sex therapy and in other settings to try to help them sort about human sexuality is to look at sexual behavior as one component, at sexual feeling or fantasy level is another, to be good, to look at affectional behavior, affectional feeling, fantasy, look at relationships, and to do that in a mode that looks at one's past, the present in your life, and looking toward the future where you want to be about that, and then looking at the parameters around them. One of this premise about homophobia being connected to sexism culturally is, I think, the telling in the response that people have to gay men and lesbian women. That often, at least my experience has been, the more violent kind of repulsed, angry reaction comes culturally toward gay men rather than lesbian women, although that's not always the case. Certainly there have been queer bashing events and lesbian women who've been beat up for being who they are too. But I think some of that comes from the idea and notion that somehow men who are viewed as homosexual are somehow fallen men, i.e. like women. And women are already viewed second order somewhere in our culture, and there's that kind of notion that they're giving up the height and the possibility about it. In talking about this, I'm not trying to set up somehow a hierarchy of oppression, that homophobia is more painful or more difficult on the list than sexism or racism or any other. Indeed, I think that we have sort of an umbrella of oppression, in which from the stems around that umbrella a whole host of different oppressions lie. I want to go through an exercise with you, and then I will try to do a brief overview of some of the things from Barr's book about weapon of sexism. And I think perhaps the group is small enough. We can divide into groups of four to do this. I want you to look at this as though you had a sheet of paper with you. Holding's not a pad and pencil kind of place, although I see one person with a pad and pen here. What I want you to do in your groups of four is we're going to do what do I call this with Dan? A slang quad analysis, I guess, is what we labeled this. But I'm going to label this set heterosexual male. That's the little symbol for male. Heterosexual female. And these homosexual male and homosexual female. And what I want you to do is to toss aside for the moment all your prim and proper propriety about saying the words that are impolite. And I want you to come up with, what are the slang words that describe these groups for us in our culture? What are the words, the put-down words that we use for them? And pretend you're teenagers for a moment. If we had a group of teenagers, they surely bring up these words much more quickly than we can. In fact, when I work with groups of teens, they are often quicker at catching hold of this exercise.
What does battle axe mean?
So who said battle axe? What does it mean?
I said battle axe.
What does it mean? They're asking in the balcony.
They're like controlling.
I say probably, you know, if I used our stereotypical response, you know, not a very feminine woman that's real, you know,
controlling.
Okay. But the kind of airhead sort of stuff.
Nimbo.
Airhead.
Cheerleader.
Airhead.
Mom. Please.
Mom. Okay.
God.
Others? Okay, down here. Did you say another?
No.
Okay. Which one of these two lower ones?
Which is
up there? It's up there. It's there.
Bitch.
Oh, that's right.
Okay.
Harlot.
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 I know, but he disagreed with me. We're having a little bit of debate.
I don't think it's ever used.
All right, you're having a debate on what?
Well, Margaret came up with the word cunt. My husband disagrees because it shouldn't be there.
It doesn't differentiate between homosexual and heterosexual.
Well, some of the words may fit in more than one place.
Yeah, old maid fits in more.
So if you see a word that fits in more than one place, then call
more
it
hetero,
out.
Or hetero, I know.
Yeah.
Okay.
Breeder.
Let's move to homosexual female. What words did you come up with here?
Dyke.
Lesbo.
Lipstick. Lesbian.
Lipstick.
Dyke.
Lips.
Butch.
Diesel dyke.
Diesel. Also known as dyke sometimes.
Women in sensible shoes.
She said, well, she was acting like a little boy. And then on the other one, the men always say Alice when they don't get it, their ball putted up to the cup. So we got a little golf term in there.
We'll just put Alice on the line here. But Nancy's over here writing
it. I thought it was real funny, though, when she says a little boy, you know, because we're always, you know, at the first time I played with a woman that said something like that.
There.
Speaking of names, my name is Bruce,
Yeah, up until Bruce Jenner, you know, Bruce was sort of...
That was a dead giveaway.
Yeah.
Bruce was a name that was considered a gay name.
Really?
Also, people with multiple syllables in their names, who wanted to be called Timothy or, you know, whatever, was the length of their name rather than the shortened butch version of it, were somehow suspect as well. There are some sex-specific words that we didn't call out and put up here. About what part of the anatomy is fucked, et cetera, that sort of stuff. So we'll just take note of that rather than calling them, since this group seems to be not wanting to do so. Take a look at these words for a moment and begin to try to do some analysis of what you see there. Where are their comparisons? Where's the most negative list of words? Where's the most, or the least negative list? How would you rank them in terms of positive to negative?
Now I'm struck with the fact that there are so many more words that appears under the heterosexual women category.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Most of them are all negative.
Yeah.
Right.
Or demeaning.
Demeaning words, okay.
And then the way you demean someone in another category is to use a word that's feminine.
Nancy or Alice.
Certainly here.
Yeah, right.
Nancy, Alice, you know. Yeah. Right. To call it a queen. To be feminine is derogatory when applied to a particular category.
A lot of the male ones are kind of like, or the heterosexual male ones are like, being jock could be derogatory, but on the other hand, that's what they supposedly aspire to, is being studly and sporting and all that kind of stuff. And then all those meat kind of aligning them with types of meat, which is kind of a nourishing, good thing in a sense. Or what, I don't know. It just seem less...
The stallion stud motif.
The stallion stud meat motif.
Yeah, okay. All right. It helps in trying to think of the words, in particular with gay and lesbian people, the kind of stereotypes about what are the things that people say about stereotypes, what are the things that give them away that you can spot them a mile away, kind of stuff. The sensible shoes sort of thing is what we put on the one side there. Limp wrist, a particular manner of walking, or those sorts of things. Do you see parallels or comparisons? Things that are much the same, or?
There's crossovers with God. Mm-hmm. Butch to men. Mm-hmm.
To heterosexual men?
Heterosexual male and homosexual female. Mm-hmm.
As I begin to look at these words, there are crossovers in these directions. Mm-hmm. That we use the same kind of feminine language to put down gay men. Or, I think we had one of those up here. To threaten these men with somehow being like these women. Mm-hmm. These men is to use the feminine. That, you know, what makes a real man? You know, that kind of, you know, there was a thing about real men don't eat quiche, assuming that gay men eat quiche. As I look at them, the parallels are this, and we find the most negative group of words describing heterosexual women and gay men. And it's not surprising to me that women seem to catch on faster about what homophobia is and sexism is, because the same kind of stuff comes at them. And in a sense, it almost seems like lesbian women, who are assumed to be able to care for themselves in the world, more like heterosexual men, because they are the ones who are also assumed to do the same sort of thing. So it's almost like a tacit pat on the back to those of us who are lesbian about being able to care for ourselves in that fashion, but at the same time feared somehow in that we might hate men. Any other comments you want to reflect out of here?
Well, I think that the lack of real negatives with the lesbians is that we just kind of disappear.
Mm-hmm. The invisibility of it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's harder to spot because all women in our society have the option of wearing pants, dressing in particular ways.
It's also true that it's I was found a lot easier as a single woman to do things with women and not ever be suspect than I think single men experience. And especially as you age too, there's very, the men die off so fast, but there's a lot of women left, and you, we're used to seeing women together
right.
a lot, and it doesn't necessarily raise the first thing to our mind that this may be a lesbian couple, as two men having dinner together might.
I think economics becomes part of it.
Right.
There are three things that Suzanne Farr lays out as being the three weapons of sexism, and she names them as economics, as violence against women, and the third one as homophobia. And she's talking about sexism being the system by which women are kept subordinate to men, and the system is kept in place by those three tools, by economic imbalance, which is part of why it's all right for two women to continue living together after high school, college, or whatever marker at which we would expect male housemates to separate and go their own way. Part of it has to do with the reality of women still continuing to earn. I think it now is 64 cents on the dollar to what men are able to earn. And that women with college degrees generally earn about the same level as males who have not been to college at all. You know, those kinds of parallels, the economic bottom lines are there. She says in the book that only 9% of all working women earn more than $25,000 a year. A surprising statistic to you?
9%?
9%.
And women make up a percentage of the workforce, I'm wondering now.
I don't know the answer to that.
Oh, almost 50.
I would say close to 50% of the workforce. It seems like economics is the bottom line for all oppression as I begin to sort and look at racial oppression, the oppression of women, in a sense at gay-lesbian oppression as well, same sort of thing. Secondly, she talks about violence against women, and we could expand that to talk about violence against gay and lesbian people as well. And it's not merely the violence itself, but the mere threat of the violence in order to keep people in line. She says, when a male abuser calls a woman a lesbian, he's not so much labeling her as a woman who loves other women, but he's warning her that by resisting him, she is choosing to be outside society's protection from male institutions, and therefore outside of protection from violence. That you know, is there as part of the norm. And the homophobia as a weapon works because of our societal heterosexism, the norm of heterosexuality, the assumption that everyone is heterosexual or should be heterosexual, and that it is heterosexism that creates the climate for homophobia with its assumptions. To resist marriage and or heterosexuality is to risk severe punishment and loss culturally. And it has with it its economic bottom lines as well, because of the tax advantages that are given to heterosexual couples, which are not given to gay or lesbian couples, or to single people, the kind of benefits that come at your workplace. Yeah.
I was wondering if any, I don't know if you know this, or if any states are recognizing homosexual or heterosexual, or homosexual couples at all for tax purposes at all.
Not statewide, any that I know of. There are some cities which have enacted domestic partnership for gay or lesbian people in the workplace so that they might add the coverage for health insurance, for example, for their spouse or partner, that sort of thing, but there's not any legal recognition. One thing that's been interesting to me now that is in Holland, in Denmark, there's one of the Scandinavian countries where gay and lesbian marriage has become legal. Now, what of the possibility of gay and lesbian people from here going there to be married and returning here? What then? How is that recognized or acknowledged, marriage in another country, which is recognized in here? Would we need to go there and take citizenship in order to this? We have to denounce our citizenship in order to have that, you know, be part of it, comes up. Farr says that the time was when the two most condemning things that could be said to a woman to ostracize or disempower her were to call her a whore or lesbian. And that in some sense, with the sexual revolution we've had going in the last 20 years, there's been some change about the labeling of the word whore, but there's been little change about lesbian. Talks about the way in which, even by definition, the thing gets turned around so that lesbian, to many people, means someone who hates men, that becomes focused on men again, rather than the definition being a woman who loves other women. You know, the negative siding of how you do that. Likewise, the same sort of not real men sort of thing. The assumption that either because of people's fears or assumptions that gay and lesbian people in a relationship, because of our heterosexism, we assume that one of those two partners in the relationship must be acting the male. This exercise points out to me that the way in which we have such strict gender role rigidity culturally about what it means to be male and what it means to be female. The other place where lesbian baiting has been used has been in the feminist movement in the last 20 years in this country. The threat of, you know, that's just a bunch of dykes kind of put down of the whole movement. And that it's interesting because that baiting of using the word lesbian is a way to sort of keep women in check still. And if you've been accused of being a lesbian, how do you disprove it? You know? What then does one do to disprove that? So what is it that we fear with the naming of that? Be we gay or lesbian, or the fear of being perceived as a gay or lesbian person? And there's a whole host of losses. Loss of employment, the loss of your family that you might be ousted from there, loss of custody rights to your own children that you have born yourself, the loss of protection societally about your own safety, perhaps the loss of self-esteem, which may end up moving you toward mental health difficulty or chemical dependency, the loss of community, the loss of credibility about being who you are. I've got another, we're going to run out of time. I've got another a sort of guided imagery sort of thing that I'd like you to take part in. And what I want you to do is to sit back, just get yourself comfortable for a moment. Think back to elementary school. Remember yourself as a little kid, 6, 7, 8, 9 years old, and focus on one person, a friend of the same sex who was special to you, either a friend of your own age or perhaps an older person or an adult, someone that you idolized. In processing this with each other, I'd invite you in dyads, in pairs of just two, to take just a couple minutes each to focus on these questions. How was the same-sex relationship treated by others? How did it change over time? And what messages did you receive about how to be in a same-sex relationship?